Hello and welcome to Summer Mesa Podcast. My name is Owen Gilmore. This week we are looking at the results of the Catalan elections, which took place yesterday. It was a pretty fascinating, and a lot of people have been saying, historic outcome in these elections. For the first time in 20 years, there has not been a majority, a pro-independence majority, elected to the Catalan Parliament. The Catalan Socialists have had one of their best results ever. Really, it's the first time they've been the largest party in terms of seats and votes. So the headline seems to be that this is the end of the Catalan process, the end of the sort of independence push for the last decade. And to discuss this in greater detail, I have with me Andrew Dowling. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, how you doing?
Andrew is a professor of history at University of Cardiff. He is the editor of the Routledge Handbook of Spanish History, which came out in late 2023, and also author of Catalonia, a New History. Andrew, how did you take the results? I mean, I was surprised at certainly the size of the fall of the independence vote, above all, obviously, on the progressive side. Junts and Puigdemont's vote stood up. We'll talk about that. But Esquerra, the incumbent party in Catalonia, the current president of Catalonia or premier, Pere Aragonès, suffered heavy losses. I think everybody was expecting the socialists to be out ahead, but maybe not expecting the considerable losses that the progressive pro-independence parties suffered.
Yeah, absolutely. There are sort of a number of takeaways in general terms. So leaving the Socialist Party aside as in theory a force of the left, overall the left did pretty badly last night, and that's
exactly
performed badly. The CUP did badly.
Yes,
Esquerra Republicana, as you rightly indicated, did very, very badly. And you know, the forces of the Spanish speaking right did well. Like, you know, they became Vox and PP.
I was very surprised at that.
Yeah, they're 20% of the vote. And also we now have a kind of like a Catalan-speaking hard right.
Yes.
This has also entered the parliament. I mean, it's a very small force, and it's a very sort of modest representation with two seats. But it leaves overall a very kind of complex picture. But I think as well, you mentioned rightly as well, that this is the first time really in 20 years that there isn't the capacity of a pro-sovereignty government to kind of retain power. But even more significant, I think, is the fact that actually it's the worst result for the forces of Catalan independence since the early 1980s. They haven't had that few seats. They've only got, you know, 61 seats in total. They haven't received a result like that since the early 1980s, back in the very early days of Jordi Pujol. So it's a blow for the cause of Catalan independence, clearly, but it's also, you know, a general blow for kind of like the capacity of Catalan nationalism in its broadest sense to retain control of the institutions.
Yes, totally. I mean, I guess going back, I mean, I was surprised. I mean, I think a lot of people were, that these snap elections were called. I mean, there was more or less a year to go in the previous parliament. Obviously, I guess what caused this, or what pushed Aragonès to call elections, was the failure to pass a budget. Or at least that was the excuse that was given. It did seem to be a moment. I guess his tactical calculation was, well, Carl Puigdemont is still in exile. He can't come. He can't come back and campaign at this moment. The amnesty law has not been passed. That would put him in a better position, or at least there was nothing to be gained by hanging on for another 6-9 months here, because, you know, without a budget, with a whole series of sort of social issues, quite concrete issues, not to do with the constitutional question, the ongoing drought, incredible scenes yesterday with the commuter rail service was basically, you know, it didn't run yesterday. And that's a chronic issue. I was in Catalonia sort of 10 days ago, and I suffered serious 2 or 3 hour delays on the railway for commuters trying to get into Barcelona or trying to travel around the province. It is very difficult. So there was nothing really to be gained by him waiting. But at the same time, now looking at it, was he wrong to call elections, or really just it wouldn't have mattered?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if they had a different result, we would be giving a different kind of perspective. So I think, you know, sometimes politicians gamble. Pedro Sánchez is a great gambler, normally his gambles pay off. Pere Aragonès gambled and lost, and now essentially he's withdrawing altogether from political life. So I think, you know, they thought they had a chance. I think they were growing ever more concerned at what became clearly the evident capacity of revival of Junts, which, you know, 8-9 months ago was deeply riven by factionalism. It was kind of like, you know, riding off in all different directions. And I think one of the things that's happened in the past 3-4 months that was kind of confirmed really during the election campaign is an attempt to give a new degree of coherence to Junts as a political force, to try to kind of, you know, they're all essentially rowing in the same direction. So there may have been a kind of perception on the part of Esquerra Republicana and Pere Aragonés that we need to kind of go now before Junts becomes a serious opponent that could kind of knock us out of the water. But in a sense, that is exactly what has just happened yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really clear what Esquerra was trying to run on. As you said, yeah, the Catalan premier has now resigned just an hour or two ago this afternoon. And they were sort of caught. Nobody sort of, the election was polarized between the socialists and Junts. One of the things, the parties didn't necessarily talk directly about the amnesty law, but it was, they were offering two narratives about what the amnesty law meant. So for the socialists or Salvadoria, it meant turning the page on the last decade, on the independence push, putting the national question to a side to concentrate on social issues. For Junts and Puigdemont, it was about his return, sort of undoing it, the historic injustice of the fact that he was deposed in 2017 after the independence push and had to go into exile. So, I mean, it was two quite clear, compelling narratives. And Esquerra, the incumbent, it wasn't clear what their narrative was. It was gestión. It was like, management, but no one seems that convinced by their management of the last 3 years. They were in a very difficult situation. It's never going to be easy, but, you know, there was a sense that, you know, hospital waiting lists are being awful in Catalonia. We've talked about the railways, the drought. You know, Catalonia has suffered one of the worst droughts in Western Europe in the last couple of years. And education, they received a terrible report, the EU or whatever, on education standards in Catalonia. And so there was a sense to stand, didn't have a clear narrative, but to stand on their government record seemed a very sort of flimsy basis, maybe.
I absolutely fully agree there. You know, if you're gonna make an electoral campaign around your record, you kind of want to make sure that you have got a good record. And I think, you know, most observers really the past couple of years have say that there have been very few shining examples within, you know, the Esquerra minority administration of any minister really in that regional government who's you know, performed at a kind of stellar level. I mean, there are problems which way you look in contemporary Catalonia. And I think, you know, we can kind of call it crumbling infrastructure can be one way of interpreting this, failures across the board in health and education, et cetera, et cetera. So what is it that Esquerra are trying to communicate? And, you know, there's a lot of discontent, a lot of unhappiness. It's also interesting to note that Esquerra's votes, that you know, most of them stayed at home. They didn't directly transfer to Carlos Puigdemont. Carlos Puigdemont, and which was obviously, you know, it was really about him. Junts, you know, he was a named individual on the ballot paper, as it were.
Yeah.
And all the in literature, very personalist. You know, very personalist campaign. So, you know, Pere Aragonés doesn't have that kind of like charisma, doesn't have that breadth or depth of capacity to mobilize. So I think, you know, it was a very risky venture, but I suppose sometimes, you know, parties choose to go to the polls when they fear that if we wait, the outcome may be even worse. But I think Esquerra Republicana did not anticipate a dreadful as a result as they did receive yesterday, that's for sure.
They were on 33, coming in sort of joint with the socialists in 2021, went down to 20. No, really, really sharp drop by losing more than a third of their seats. I mean, you mentioned, I guess, yet Junts' campaign very much centered on Puigdemont. It was a very atypical campaign. I think quite interesting in some ways. Probably only the figure of Puigdemont could sort of run this type of campaign where, firstly, he was obviously run from exile. He refused to engage in any of the debates, the leaders' debates, even though Obviously, he couldn't attend in person because there's still an arrest warrant out for him in Spain. But they, I think in all the debates, they were, he was offered participation telematically, or including, I think, Esquerra were willing to go, you know, Pedro Arganes was willing to go to the south of France to debate him in person in Perpignan or wherever. So he didn't participate in the debates, but he sort of positioned himself as nearly above the fray, you know, like a sort of he's like the sort of national leader in exile who wasn't going to engage in party politics. You know, debating was for, like, you know, the sort of mere mortals. He was sort of above this. I mean, could you talk me a little bit about Johnson's campaign in that sense? Obviously, do you think, I mean, in one sense, as you said, compared to where they were 6-9 months ago, it's a strong result. But in a sense, has Puigdemont now used the last bullet, you know, available to him in that sense? You know, is this as good as it's going to get for him?
I think so. And also he made, you know, one of his innumerable promises that are never fulfilled, one assumes, again, on this case, that he said he's not interested in returning to Catalonia to be a leader of the opposition. And he said that if that transpires, that is the outcome, he will quit frontline politics. But he's promised on several occasions since the autumn of 2017 that he will return triumphant to Catalonia, and he's never followed through. So we'll see what he does this time. I think that there's a couple of other things I think that are important to think about Junts and Puigdemont in particular. Puigdemont is very polarizing, and there's a lot of pro-independent supporters who are deeply hostile to Puigdemont. Some of the hardcore pro-independence people think he's a traitor. So, you know, on that side, there's kind of like a lot of hostility. He's seen to embody the betrayal of the autumn of 2017, and he fled. There's that narrative from hardcore. And then there's also obviously political rivals like Esquerra Republicana. Junqueras and Puigdemont essentially don't speak with each other. They barely had a political relationship when they're in government together, et cetera. So there are deep unhealed wounds on that side of the political framing as well. The other really important thing, I think I began to wonder about this just when we saw some of the early results, is that in the non-independence areas of Catalonia yesterday, we actually saw voting increase above average. And speaking to a couple of people, there are people who felt that Puigdemont may have actually also produced a boomerang effect of people who were deeply anxious in the autumn of 2017 and then have gradually come, you know, then they voted for Ciudadanos in December 2017, and they've gradually sort of relaxed about any danger of independence. And this kind of like incredible campaign of Puigdemont focused around, we're going to finish the job of 2017, etc. We'll see what the political scientists find out when they look into the raw data, but there may well be an indication that focusing so much on Puigdemont has been counterproductive for the independence cause. And that explains, like, Illia's result in the end of 42 seats was higher than any opinion poll predicted. So there may be indications of that. Also, we must acknowledge briefly that the Popular Party tripled its votes. Vox maintained, Vox has been on a downwards trajectory in many senses across different regional and local elections in Spain. It more than held its own yesterday as well. The conservative Spanish-speaking right attained 20% of the vote. So we'll see, banking everything on Puigdemont, it's kind of like it's only a modest increase of the vote, and there is no independence majority. Carlos Puigdemont is not going to be the next president of Catalonia. Will he fulfill his promise about quitting politics? To be determined.
I guess there are various scenarios. One is that, firstly, we have to say, One of the reasons why it now seems like an error to have called these snap elections was the fact that there's so much unknown around the amnesty. I mean, I suppose, like, obviously it's meant to come into effect in the next, I don't know, the next couple of months, or the next month, 6 weeks. It's not clear the exact date it will be sent back to the Congress to be approved. The right-wing majority of the Senate are going to block it, going to veto it. We'll have to go back then to the Congreso. It seems the socialists, Pedro Sanchez, don't want to vote on it before the European elections because that just will sort of reignite the issue. it probably won't go back to the Congreso until after the European elections. We're talking sort of mid-June. And then we're getting into the sort of points of obviously the negotiations in Catalonia, but there will be some sort of investiture vote at some point. And Puigdemont won't be able, probably at that point, won't be able to come back, I imagine. No, he at, still, when they have at least the initial vote for here, he won't be in the country. Mm-hmm. It's very messy to predict, even just because there's so many unknowns around the amnesty law and around what the judicial reaction to that law will be. Well, you know, obviously it's going to have to be implemented by the Supreme Court, by various other courts. It's not clear what they're going to do, what their maneuvers are, how willing are they just going to be to sort of implement it? Will they just push it out for 2 months, the limit, or will they try and find loopholes, which we've been reassured there aren't any loopholes, but it's, you know, what margin for interpretation is there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think this will actually play in. I think that there are a number of scenarios from now on in terms of what happens next. But I think nobody really wants to run the risk of new elections in October. I think that, you know, the two victorious forces yesterday will probably want to kind of rest on their victory. The forces that did badly yesterday would absolutely not want to go to the polls again because, you know, maybe their result is even worse, particularly in the case of the Esquerra Republicana, particularly in the case of the CUP, and to some extent in the case of Comuns, the beneficiaries are likely to be forces of kind of like, you know, identity politics, whether it speaks in Spanish or whether it speaks in Catalan. So, you know, in the old days, people used to say, you know, that people would be sitting in smoke-filled rooms negotiating and doing lots of deals. Obviously, nobody smokes anymore, but I think that we're going to see a long period of kind of backroom negotiations. You know, one of the things that has been speculated about in Catalan political culture for a while is some almost unimaginable deal between the socialists and Junts to kind of share power. And I would point to the surprising outcome in Ireland, where once nobody would ever have predicted a government formed by Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael as a kind of coalition administration, kind of sharing power, sharing the government. But, you know, sometimes when they look around them and they see that the alternative is worse, that maybe there is capacity. So there may be a scenario. I don't think there's any, apart from the Catalan Alliance, apart from the PP and Vox, who will be the main beneficiaries, I think, of new elections in October. I don't think any of the other remaining forces want to take the risk of a kind of an already demobilized electorate, an already demotivated electorate. Catalonia is also likely to suffer a pretty extreme summer, you know, in more likely than not. The issues around climate, et cetera, these issues around infrastructure and the rail network are not going away. So, you know, there aren't any variables, I think, for the main forces in Catalonia that think waiting again and going again in October will produce a better result. So I think they have to find a solution to some kind of form of administration.
I mean, Esquerra Republicana have come out and said they're going into opposition. They don't want their votes. They don't want their votes led to the socialists, to Salvador Illa as candidates. And I mean, and that makes sense. I mean, they can only be burnt further by agreeing to some sort of either coalition or parliamentary alliance. So it does the question: what is the relationship between Junts and the socialists in that case? Because Puigdemont has the capacity to undermine the governments in Madrid, the national governments. To what extent do these results make it nearly impossible to pass a budget, you know, a national budget for 2025? But obviously, Puigdemont will lose his influence in Madrid if the government falls. I mean, there is a sort of sense, you know, he's playing hardball at the moment. He's come out, he said that the socialists should abstain, allow him and Esquerra to form a government or for Junts to form a government with Esquerra's active support. Whether that's a bluff or, you know, in a more complicated negotiated game, it's not clear at this point.
Well, I think you know, going back to what will for many people be a deeply unsettling and, and surprising possibility of some kind of accommodation between junts and the socialists. Together, those two blocs can form a solid parliamentary majority. It's the only plausible parliamentary majority. Now, clearly, they're deeply divided around the national question and deeply divided around the question of independence. But independence is not on the horizon in the next 3-4 years. You know, yesterday, the independence vote, you can't claim a mandate for independence when they got 43% of the overall vote. That is not a mandate for independence. So whatever happens, independence is not on the horizon in the medium term future. Therefore, what is on the horizon? Well, actually, if you look at them in terms of economic policy, in terms of attitudes towards infrastructure and things like the very contentious issue like Hard Rock in Tarragona, the Winter Olympics, an extra runway at Barcelona Airport. Interestingly, the socialists and junts share the same economic position about kind of like, you know, there's no indication, there's no hint in any of them other than a very technocratic view of economic policy. There's nothing about kind of, you know, making kind of adjustments because of dramatic issues around climate change, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the form of social democracy represented by Salvador Illa is a very conservative Starmerist vision of social, you know, it's barely, you know, you've added so much water to the wine, it barely kind of like tastes of wine anymore. It's a highly, highly diluted social democratic message. So it's not implausible. Remember, of course, that Pedro Sanchez has done well once again. I think he can be broadly satisfied.
Yeah.
But the Catalan question is the big stone in his shoe. Not now that independence is off the agenda, not in that sense, but to somehow survive in power for the next, you know, 2-3 years, he needs the continued support of Esquerra Republicana and Junts so they can kind of make demands of him. So I think the reason I'm putting this on the table, even if it seems highly implausible, a situation where Junts and the socialists can somehow share the Generalitat will also provide Pedro Sanchez with an extra layer of political stability in Madrid. Now, maybe it's a highly implausible possibility, but what's been known as socioventia, as in the socialist plus convergencia, you know, they're now known as Junts, has been mooted in Catalan political culture on and off for quite a few years. And you know, many people do say, particularly Esquerra Republicana and other on the Catalan left, that actually, you know, they're not that divided when it comes to economic questions. So I think it's the least likely scenario, but it could occur if the alternative are more elections.
What you're describing, I think it's been dubbed the tarmac coalition, though, because the same sort of idea of infrastructural development, etc., new roadways, the big Hard Rock casino, etc. I mean, obviously that the Hard Rock leads us on to the Comunes and the radical left in Catalonia. I mean, They decided to veto the budget on the basis of this sort of mega casino that was going to be built in Tarragona. It wasn't necessarily linked to the budget. That was a sort of strange thing. I mean, this was an add-on to the budget they decided to take a stand on. I mean, it seems a strange moment for them to try and, you know, force new elections as well. In the sense, it's clear whatever the independence movements does. Deep demobilization, but also on the radical left. I mean, it hasn't been a good year for the left since the election, since Sumar's decent results last July. I think they were hoping for a sort of a year to rebuild or put down some sort of roots and organizational structure. Instead, they've had to fight a series of very difficult regional elections, now going into the European elections. I mean, they've had one of the worst results, I think, again. It's 15-20 years. Where do you see them? I mean, obviously they were second in the national elections in Catalonia last year, but at a regional level internally in Catalonia, they are now increasingly a marginal force. And yet they, you know, today they came out and said they would like to join some sort of progressive coalition, which seems a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, the communes, which are sort of form part of the broader Sumar coalition, have been damaged by the whole, you know, the whole soap opera really around Sumar and Podemos since the creation of Sumar I think that's definitely had effect. It's had a big demoralizing, demotivating effect on many voters who were once really energized. We should remember that, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, communes were capable of winning 30% plus in elections. So it's a dramatic, you know, downward spiral that doesn't really seem to have any particular end in sight. Perhaps they've touched bottom, but, you know, there's you know, what we can call kind of radical left narratives, really, have lost all of their capacity to energize their voters, energize their activist base, etc. It's you know, it's a long and sad and sorry story. And I think, you know, it's clearly impacted on the corpus valor, which obviously have had a much more radical political agenda. But, you know, they lost their two seats last July in the Spanish general election. They performed badly in local elections. They've also been on a downward trajectory. I think partly they rode the wave, in a sense, of a certain type of radical independentist narrative. That's, you know, that's the big differentiating factor with Corp. But I think we can also contrast it with developments in the Basque Country, where Bildu go against the grain and have actually demonstrated themselves to know how to speak to voters. And to some extent, the BNG and Galicia as well have also been able to do that. So it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be an eternal downward trajectory. But I think, I mean, from my point of view with CUP, I mean, I think they've made enormous strategic errors aligning themselves with right-wing Catalan forces over, you know, because of the push for independence. They basically, you know, they made essentially allowed Quim Torra to be president. They've allowed kind of like, you know, they've done all sorts of intellectual gymnastics to try to keep a broad pro-independence coalition in power, etc., etc. And, you know, it's had diminished credibility, and I think it's particularly eroded their credibility on the social question, where they do have a really radical agenda. They tried to make this campaign, actually, they barely spoke about independence. They tried to make it about climate change, but I think, you know, if it's like a car suddenly changing direction, it's not convincing. It's you know, you need to be building this narrative for quite a long time, and clearly nobody was convinced by it in this election.
And you mentioned earlier the strong showing of the Spanish right. One person I saw on Twitter made the observation that there's now a majority, what would you say, like a 155 majority in the Catalan Parliament. The parties that would have supported the suspension of Catalan autonomy in 2017 after the independence push, which is quite remarkable. You talked a little bit about, I mean, what might be behind the PP's pretty decent results in terms of Ciudadanos voters coming out of fear, you know, being mobilized as much out of fear of by Puigdemont and the sort of a potential return there. What else do you see, particularly because I think it seemed more like it was going to be a sort of zero-sum game between Vox and PP, and in the end, Vox held its ground, you know, sort of repeated its result from 3 years ago, while the PP had this sharp increase. How do you explain this result? And obviously, one element here was migration, particularly around the PP. They don't tend to engage that much in anti-immigration rhetoric in much of the rest of Spain. But in Catalonia, it seems to be a sort of vector for mobilization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's in a sense, it all goes back to kind of economic questions, and it comes back to infrastructure questions as well, immigration, in the sense that when you have, from many points of view of many Catalans, where you have an education system under pressure, where you have the health service under pressure, where you have rail and transport infrastructure under pressure, et cetera, at the same time as you are receiving mass immigration, you do not have the capacity to easily assimilate that immigration. Therefore, for certain types of voters there, it is possible to mobilize them around an anti-immigration narrative. I don't think there's ever been much in Spain in terms of immigrants competing for employment that jobs that Spaniards want to do. I don't think that's ever been an effective narrative, but there's a definite sense that we've got all these immigrants now as well, and we've got an education system that's failing. We've got a health service that, you know, is unable to kind of address the needs of Catalan society. We've got crumbling infrastructure in a whole range of areas. So I think immigration has been, and this, you know, Alianza Catalana has also obviously spoken about this as well, although it's framed in a very different way, that immigration has a degree of salience. And I think it is, another thing that's very important that we've seen replicated across Europe, there are increasing evidence that young men between the ages of 18 and 30 are drawn to hard right narratives, are drawn to hard right political narratives. There's a clear gender divide going on there. We probably need a lot more information to fully understand this process. But we do know that, for example, you know, it's been commented on that Vox have been really effective at social media that I don't use, things like TikTok and Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. So they've got pretty effective capacity to appeal to certain voter bases. The PP are operating on a different terrain. It's a kind of older voter, but Vox are pretty good at appealing to a certain young cohort.
A researcher who's been on this podcast before, Iago Moreno, told me a few weeks ago that basically, yeah, he's doing research into social media elections. He said something like, right now it seems that the far right have the social media and all we have are the ministries, i.e. the left. Mm-hmm. And it is a worry that the right seems to be much more effective in terms of social media, and the left response seems to be sort of policy, which doesn't necessarily translate into politically into a narrative.
Yeah, just sorry on that then. Just briefly on that then, I think one of the things that is important and will be interesting to watch will be the presence of Silvia Oriols in the parliament.
Yes.
Because leaving her side, her politics, I think we have to acknowledge that she is an excellent political communicator. She's been really effective on building a social base, really, on social media, but she's also an excellent speaker. She's really good at simplifying political messages. She's really effective, you know, and they've been some of the party leaders, you know, who had varying results yesterday are varying degrees of competence in terms of their own political charisma. But Silvia Oriols has had a degree of traction because she is a charismatic political figure in her own right. And I think, you know, dizzling into what you're saying, that the right or the hard right, the extreme right, seems to be able to find these figures, which clearly facilitates their own political communication.
It is an interesting one because obviously, yeah, 10 years ago, I think there was a sense that social media was obviously necessarily progressive, or was a sort of an emancipatory tool nearly, and that the left was more skilled in that type of thing. That's obviously changed a lot in the last decades. I mean, I'm quite interested in Catalan in that sense, because I literally don't know much about them as a party. Obviously, the actual nationalism between Spanish, the sort of hard right Spanish nationalism box and a lot of Alliance, divides them. How would you compare them beyond that, like in terms of their positioning on immigration, their sort of discourse? How would you make the comparison between the two parties?
Yeah, there's an important difference. I think the difference really, I mean, you know, Alianza Catalana is to some extent a personalist political project. It was literally a one-woman band for quite a while. Silvia Oriols used to be part of a hard-right grouping in Catalonia, Front Nacional de Catalunya, National Front of Catalonia, and she initially obtained local representation for this party. But she has been spouting and speaking a kind of anti-immigrant, but essentially an anti-Muslim political message for quite a long time. And basically, she broke with them and created her own formation. Now, Front Nacional de Catalunya has basically disappeared, and she has been able to capitalize on this sentiment. So firstly, I think the important thing is she's a deeply Catholic individual. So her political framing is very religious, and she's kind of fighting a religious war in a sense. Her hostility to Islam is kind of like religious, and then it's also framed racially as well. So she's deeply and profoundly opposed to Muslim immigration, to what she considered. So, you know, in a sense, it's kind of like Orbanism. In a sense, that she's very much framed things in terms of Christian civilization. I think Vox in Catalonia doesn't really speak in those terms. For a start, their principal candidate is kind of like, you know, non-white and things like that. So there's that that's really, really important about it. She's 100% pro independence. She's from Ripoll, which is kind of like, you know, the sort of the center of historic Catalonia. It was the place where the medieval kings of Catalonia were buried. So it's got incredible symbolic traction as well. And so she's framing it in a, you know, Catalan society is receiving a lot of immigration. There are a lot of pressures. There are, you know, people have been speaking for quite a long time, partly to undermine Ada Colau when she was mayor of Barcelona. But there is, I think, clear evidence of increased street robberies, increased violent crime in the city of Barcelona and in other Catalan towns and cities. So Oriol frames all of that around blaming the immigrant, but above all, blaming the Muslims, blaming the Moroccans, etc., blaming the Algerians. That's kind of how she differentiates herself from Vox. She's also an unmarried Catholic mother who has five children, but she's also very progressive on LGBT. So kind of like right-wing Israeli politics, she plays the gay card as a lever to critique Islam.
Okay. Yes. Okay.
So that's the thing she does.
Okay. No, very interesting. I mean, I guess in that sense, I mean, I guess one of the other differences maybe is that obviously Vox was a breakaway from the mainstream right. Yeah. She has come from very much the extreme, the extra parliamentary extreme right, the Frente Nacional de Catalunya.
But then they describe themselves as hardcore nationalists. They would like extreme right. She rejects that label, by the way.
Okay, well that's good to know. I suppose, I mean, one of the things, I guess, obviously Catalonia has voted, I think, what, four times in the last year. If we count, we're coming up to European elections. Now we had local elections last May, general. Now we've had the Catalan elections, and then we have the European elections coming up in June. I mean, they've also had very, you know, a series of very short-term governments over the last few years. There is a sense of political exhaustion. A sense of political exhaustion. We've said the sort of political gravity of the Catalan parliament has also sort of shifted to the right. I mean, to what extent is this result, do you see this result, I guess, as a vindication of the socialists? And to what extent is it sort of a sign of just political exhaustion?
Yeah. I mean, I think that you know, referring to all the political exhaustion, which I fully agree with, means really that, as I mentioned earlier, that almost at all costs, most parties won't want to see a repeat of elections in October, because as you rightly said, you know, as soon as the dust settles on this, we've got almost, you know, starting up again the European elections, which always have a certain degree of kind of salience in Spain compared to, I think, other European societies. So there will be seen as to some extent a referendum on Pedro Sanchez. The PP will be desperate to perform well, etc., etc. So there's that. I mean, I think it is an end of an era, really. You know, I mean, people have been talking about the post process for quite a long time, but this is the definitive end of the process. As you mentioned earlier, you know, the forces of 155 yesterday obtained 53% of the vote. The pro-independence forces, including Alianza Catalana, obtained 43% as a maximum figure. So nobody can plausibly claim, as I stated, there is a mandate for independence. It cannot be part of the political framing, political agenda for the foreseeable future. It's, you know, in that sense, Catalonia is going through a similar kind of independence crisis as we're also witnessing in Scotland, where a period of deep and profound belief in both places that independence was almost in the bag, imminent, or one last push was necessary, is now a can that's being, you know, kicked so far down the road that we've got no idea what kind of political scenario we'll be dealing with in 2027, 2028. And that's really, the long meanwhile, as this, they're referring to it now as a kind of, you know, mientras tanto, a long meanwhile, while they have to concentrate on essentially bread and butter, ordinary issues. So broadly advantageous, again, for Pedro Sanchez, but also there are other political forces who can take, you know, positive framing You know, the PP, they've never done particularly well in Catalonia, but they can be pleased in comparative terms with their result, particularly, again, compared to that of the Basque Country.
We are, as you said, just sort of uncharted territory. It is all speculation at the moment. I mean, where does that be reached upon as a political figure? I mean, what in the best case scenario for Jones, they reach some sort of arrangement with the socialists. I mean, whether that would actually be advantageous for them and actually going forward is another thing. But I mean, he's not going to go in as obviously as a member of a socialist led coalition or arrangements. Are we sort of talking about sort of him as a sort of extra parliamentary leader? Maybe part of his campaign, it was surprising how little independence was spoken about. The core message was that he was going to return, undo this sort of historic wrong, you know, restore the presidency. I think that they were talking about restoring the presidency. But his other core message was he was the only figure who could say no to Sanchez, who could stand up to Sanchez and could extract meaningful concessions. And I mean, in that sense, I guess there is any sort of arrangement between the socialists and Jones would require significant concessions from the socialists. The 7 seats they have in Ireland, in the Spanish Congreso, in Parliament of Madrid, still have the same weight they did before these elections. They still have an effective veto on the budget, on everything going forward, all legislation. I mean, I think one of the things that's been noted in the Catalan press is how Catalan employers, the Catalan corporate sector have reached out to Puigdemont in recent weeks to, for example, they blocked Junts voted against the legislation that would have made it mandatory to have trade union representatives on the boards of all companies. They do have a sort of a veto to condition all legislation, the whole agenda going forward of the coalition, moving it to the right, because, you know, we are talking about a centre-right neoliberal party. There is, I imagine, the temptation to sort of blow it all up, but then you lose that veto. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, that's the dilemma I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it'll be interesting to see if, as is more highly likely, Puigdemont cannot be the next president of Catalonia, what he chooses to do. I mean, he's a divisive figure, but he's also got an incredibly loyal base who will forgive, essentially will forgive and do forgive him anything. You know, that he's kind of like, he's a sacred figure. He's a symbolic figure. He's a kind of like, you know, as you indicated earlier, he's a kind of like this national totem in a certain sense. So should he withdraw? I think he even if he withdraws and just, you know, wanders around the streets of Girona or something for a period of time, I'm sure he'll kind of like return when the circumstances are more favorable. He may, you know, just choose to sort of be low profile for a year or two and take up the banner again if the circumstances are better. But I think it also produces a crisis for Junts. Should he choose to walk away, they've got nobody who has that mobilizing capacity. They kind of had Laura Borras, but she was also very divisive and is also kind of like, you know, been damaged by the issues of corruption. Outside of that, they've got almost nobody really who you could say has that kind of capacity like Puigdemont has to appeal to and to mobilize and to motivate. You know, you had hundreds, if not thousands, of people getting the bus every day to go and listen to him in France.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and there are not many politicians who can achieve that, and Puigdemont has that capacity. So, you know, again, as you, we're very much in the realms of speculation here. Puigdemont stated, as I mentioned in the beginning, he did not want to be leader of the opposition. He does not want to be. So if he's going to, you know, adhere to that, returning to the Catalan Parliament in that scenario means that he will probably just withdraw from political life. But I don't think it will be a permanent withdrawal in the way that Pere Aragonès has essentially thrown in the towel. Pere Aragonès went bouncing back. He's had his chance and it's gone.
No, yeah. Yeah. No, he did, well, he doesn't have to get the political capital more in the bank as such. I mean, on the amnesty question, how did you see that playing out the next couple of months? Again, this is sort of speculation, but it's an interesting thing because I think people outside of Spain, the amnesty law made international news. It's received a certain amount of attention in the political press, etc. But I think there was a sense, okay, that agreement was done as such. And obviously it is more complicated now because we've had sort of a 6-month negotiation period. That's now come to the end. But there, I don't know. I mean, there seems to be a lot of question about how exactly it's going to be implemented and what happens there next.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's clearly not unconnected in a certain sense with, you know, Pedro Sanchez himself almost throwing in the towel because really of a parapolitical force, which is the Spanish judiciary, which really is what he was kind of like talking about when he kind of spoke about his willingness to continue and obviously a very hostile media environment. If probably more likely than not, the forces of the Spanish right continue to try to undermine the amnesty law, in a sense that brings Junts and Pedro Sanchez together, because Pedro Sanchez rightly can say, this isn't me. It's these hard-right Spanish nationalist fanatics. And I think Junts kind of has to recognize that because that is more or less the truth. And only Pedro Sanchez can deliver the amnesty for them. They want their figures amnestied, and so does Esquerra Republicana. I mean, you know, it, we're linked to that really. You know, Pedro Aragonés is gone, but I think it's also highly debatable the role of Oriol Junqueras, who's been waiting, in a sense, for quite a long time to be able to return to frontline politics. But he is really the single most important architect of the change in policy of Esquerra Republicana over the past few years. Yeah. It's been very driven by him. And arguably, the results yesterday mean that his time is up as well. But he may choose to not recognize that. He has a certain degree of charisma and popularity on a kind of personal level. He may try to, but it may be unsustainable within his own party, even if he's fully amnestied and can return to frontline politics, that, you know, the time of Oriol Junqueras is over. So, you know, I think the amnesty law will pass in time. It's just how long it takes. And I think whilst we're waiting for it to be finally completed, It kind of, you know, Pedro Sanchez, but just bringing it back to his own declaration when he said he was staying in frontline politics, he kind of claimed that he was going to try to do something about these parapolitical forces. And we haven't seen any evidence of that. Are there going to be new measures around the judiciary and the politicization of the Spanish judiciary? Perhaps certain controls around the media in terms of, you know, basic falsehoods or something? That I haven't seen any political pronouncements in that sense. So is that just mere rhetoric on the day? I think that will be important to see. Maybe something will come up in the European elections. Maybe that will be what he begins to talk about. I don't know. It will be interesting to see particularly how the PP and Vox and the Socialists run the European elections campaign, to what extent this issue is there and what will be the subjects of the issue. Because I think... if you think about when the amnesty was passed, initially passed, the mobilizations that were taking place in Madrid and in other Spanish cities, you know, it faded very quickly. The amnesty, just like, you know, the release from prison of the Catalan leadership, it was mounted, you know, or framed rather by the forces of the Spanish right as a kind of apocalyptic moment, and it faded from view.
Yeah.
Very quickly. And I think the amnesty, I think, had diminishing capacity to mobilize voters. But again, that will be determined, I think, in the next few weeks and months, and partly how it plays out. But, you know, Puigdemont has almost returned. You know, the only thing he didn't do was step on Spanish door. But he participated in all the ways in a full electoral campaign, which he kind of hadn't really done in the past few years. He was the leading figure in many senses during the whole election. So I think it's kind of like he is banked in, and the fact of him now, he's not going to be taking power in the general electorate. He's not going to be able to kind of, you know, symbolically give the finger, if you want, to the Spanish right over the next few years. At best, he may be in the parliament, highly unlikely. He may be just, you know, wandering around the streets of Girona, saying, meeting and chatting to people you used to kind of, you know, live and know years previously. So
I mean, it does take the sort of wind out of a sail, like in terms of like the idea of a triumphant return. Now I think it's
absolutely, there is no plausible triumphant return. Now he cannot come back and claim he was removed, and now he's come back to claim the throne that was wrongly taken from him in December 2017. That's off the table. So yeah. that sort of, you know, that affects the capacity of the Spanish rightist media system to use him as a battering ram again against Pedro Sánchez.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the last point I would just say is, you would presume, you would hope that there's a period in which there won't be elections in Spain after European elections in June. I mean, as we said, it's not just in Catalonia, it's across the Spanish state. There's just fatigue, exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we're talking very fragile governing majorities. They made the last coalition work at the national level. This one's even more complicated. Spanish left have to now govern. They have to actually move policy priorities forward, because the last year has been one of deadlock, largely because of this constant electoral battle. You had the negotiation, the amnesty, that you said, you know, some, we've had four elections since Christmas, you know, between Christmas and June. So I think you would hope this second coalition government can now actually start governing.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. And I think I bring back to what I said earlier about the club. I saw a useful observation made about the club. Over the past 6-7 years, they've given such priority to the national question that they've kind of like forgotten about how they can kind of deliver practical improvements for ordinary people. And, they delivered almost nothing with their two seats in the Spanish parliament. In fact, they kind of pretty much said no to everything, including, you know, comparatively decent, labor reform, et cetera. And, you know, what the CUP have done in the Catalan parliament, just sort of aligning itself with the Catalan right over the past 7-8 years, really has delivered nothing in terms of meaningful social policy. So it's clear that people are kind of like hurting, people are suffering, and people do feel the need to see politicians, the political class, deliver some tangible benefits. Otherwise, they're not going to vote for them.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I think we can definitely agree on that. I mean, I guess that's it. The next couple of weeks are going to be dominated by the European elections, and we have to see where the dust settles after that. But it's, I think what you were saying in terms of Pedro Sánchez, it's true. It looked as if before Christmas, maybe the amnesty could hurt him more. That, you know, the PP were trying to frame the European elections very much as a referendum on Sánchez. A decent result for the socialists in the Basque Country, and now pretty historic results in Catalonia. Pretty good polling for the European elections. It looks as if he's going to be in a strong enough position after the summer. Obviously, at the same time, his coalition partner, Sumar, they're putting off their sort of internal civil war until after the European elections. Let's see where that goes. Obviously, in a sense, it's going to be a battle. Sumar, Podemos. Podemos have a very recognizable figure in Irene Montero as their candidate. I mean, I'm not sure. Can you name the candidate for Sumar? I'm only asking you because I think most people can't. She's very little known.
I cannot.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the issue. Nobody knows. She's probably a very, very, very decent ex-director of the refugee association here. But, you know, I think she has 5,000 or 6,000 followers on social media, 3,000 on Instagram. She's an unknown. I think it's going to be very
difficult. No, it's not that. I still haven't fully assimilated the new leader of the Basque Nationalist Party. I keep forgetting his name because he was sort of brought in with very low name recognition, and it still hasn't fully been assimilated by me.
The nice thing when you have a party which is 100 years old is the sort of the previous leader was willing to sort of step aside without any sort of the sense of internal discipline that there wasn't this sort of crisis of a leadership transition, which you get in a lot of parties. Well, look, Andrew, I think that's really been a really interesting conversation. I mean, let's hope there's no need for a further Catalan election special in October. I want to break from electoral politics. I think certainly everybody I know in Madrid and elsewhere in Spain also wants a break from electoral politics. As always, it was great talking to you.
No, it's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed like the questions and the observations you made as well. It's been really thoughtful and enjoyable. Thank you.
Cheers, Andres. Thanks.